Welcome to What in God's Name? He's Chris Owen.
She is Shayna Appel.
And we are the show that takes a look at current events through the lenses of theology and philosophy. Chris, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, Shayna.
So we are here today with part two of Chris's interview with Randy Mayer. If you haven't listened to part one, I would encourage you to do that. That was last week's show.
Yes, Randy started a group, or his church started a ministry, and they call themselves the Samaritans, and they provide humanitarian aid for migrants who are out in the Sonoran Desert.
As was true with the part one, Chris, as I listened to this half of the interview, I noted it sort of broke down into some natural sections for me. A very powerful part in the interview where Randy talks about the number of people who are actually dying out in the desert. And that was a wake-up call for me. And then you guys did this wonderful journey around a quote by Christian Heyer. And then finally, the whole thing about host and guest, the idea that when we do mission work, we are ministering to people, but they are also ministering to us, sometimes in ways that aren't readily apparent. So we'll play the interview now, and folks, listen for those sections. We'll come back and talk about it on the other side.
Thanks for setting that up, Shayna. Let's listen to Randy and me.
This image is sticking with me, and I just want to share it with you. This circles back to the beginning of the conversation, but your description of there's a human being in front of you who has need, and you are going to respond, and that was the beginnings of your Samaritans group work, that people were dying near you, and what are we going to do? So there's no question there. I just wanted to share with you that is sticking with me, and I think it's beautiful and it's powerful.
Yeah, it really is. If there were 3,000 people dying in your community, would your community not respond, or what would you do? Perspective, our response has been, until our government can figure the politics out, we have no choice but to give humanitarian aid.
So the 3,000 people, 3,200, I think you said, that have died since 2000, that's just near you.
Just in our area of the desert. It's, you know, across the border, it could be, you know, it's 8,000, 9,000. That's recovered remains. Yeah. You know, we consider, you know, if you get out in the desert, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. Just in a little neighborhood south of Green Valley, some of our Samaritans found 3 remains. In the last 5 years, they have since found maybe 20 remains just in that mile and a half area. Because, you know, in the desert, everything, you know, the bodies just decay, the animals tear them apart, and the bones are scattered. And so there's very little to recover. And we kind of consider that for every body that's found, there's has to be at least 2 to 3 bodies that haven't been found. So that number could be as many as 20 to 25,000 across the border.
Since 2000?
Yeah, roughly, because the deaths really began to shoot up after 98, 2000.
I want to read to you a quote from a article by Kristen Heyer, who's at Boston College. She's a theologian there. So she says, religious practices, narratives, and symbols hold the potential to shape, she says, believers' moral imagination, but I want to say everybody's moral imagination, and counter the collective delusion that we're not responsible. The Jewish commandment of loving the stranger.
Yeah.
And the Christian teaching of subversive hospitality. I mean, these are all of the things that you've been talking about and lived and embody. And the Buddhist teaching, which I'm not familiar with, but I love this, the Buddhist teaching of interdependent co-arising. But they all suggest this mutuality and this recognition of the common humanity and the common journey.
And I guess that that's what's powerful is you do begin to see this core story being told over and over again. And that's what it means to be faithful. You know, what I love about Jesus is that Jesus says, follow me. And, you know, you look at the group of people that he had and you say, my God, you know, people that had lots of faults and struggles. And he didn't necessarily say, you got to believe this stuff first. He said, follow me and you're going to learn on the way. And so really what I see about the faith story is we practice. It's a practice. We learn. We learn from others. You know, that's why the sanctuary movement is so important for this movement, is that it was a practice and they practiced it. And we learn from them. We learn from other instances in history of people going out of their way to offer hospitality. And it begins to be your practice. It becomes your discipline. And can you wander from that? And to wander from that really means that you have to cut the connections to those deep stories. So it really becomes this very well-worn routine. I think that's the beauty of really going deep in your tradition. And you can walk in those deep ruts that were carved out long before you. It may not be, you know, the religious tradition might not be for everybody, but those practices begin to have a really deep meaning. So like in our Samaritan group, about a third of them, we have 300 volunteers, a third of them are from the Good Shepherd, 100 of them are from other churches and faith traditions, and 100 of them are really non-faith and people of conscience. And yet we all come together and learn this deep practice from different perspectives, but it serves everybody well.
I didn't realize that about your Samaritans group. And that is also a beautiful picture. People of different faiths.
Yeah.
And people of how you're describing, which I like also, people of conscience.
Yeah.
People who may not have a theistic belief or faith.
Yeah.
But whatever they have, they are people of conscience. They have a sense of morality there.
The other beautiful thing about it is that then from a church perspective, you know, we have created this platform for ministry where any and all can come and participate equally. There's nobody that has a bigger role. It's everybody's equal. Everybody can drive the vehicle. Everybody can go out and do the work in the desert, and you just put your name on the schedule. And yet the church is legally responsible, and the church is willing to take that risk because we believe in this ministry, to provide this platform and to provide this support to migrants in the desert.
One last thing I want to ask you about. I heard you say about Jesus that he is both host and guest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit as you relate that to this work.
Some of it comes out of just reflecting on that, the passage from Hebrews about entertain strangers, for you never know when you're going to be serving angels unaware. And so it really becomes, you know, we have literally found Jesus in the desert, literally, Jesus. Migrants named Jesus, but it's a lot more than that. It really becomes about, you know, people, our Samaritans go out in the desert to save lives, literally to save lives, and we have saved lives in the desert. But oftentimes they find a migrant, and in the process of giving them first aid and support and the humility of the migrant and hearing the story, somehow the roles are reversed, and what you begin to, the Samaritan comes out of that situation and says, my life has changed, what I just experienced. And yet that migrant who just received life-saving aid is saying, my God, I thought all of these people were going to come and be hateful and turn me in, and yet that's not what I experienced. I met this angel unaware. And I think that's really what Jesus was all about. He knew how to be guest and servant, and that's what we need to be able to do in our work as people of faith. Is in the midst of being a servant, we're also being served, and it's always that moving back and forth between those
two things.
There's
a virtuous cycle of reciprocity that builds it and overflows.
If you're doing it in the right spirit and really being in that groove, those things happen.
Is there anything I didn't ask that you wish I had, or anything that you would like to add for our listeners today?
You know, I continue to say everybody needs an immigrant as a friend. Learn the story and your life will be changed. It happens all the time. And that's how we're going to get out of this vicious cycle we're in, is people are going to finally say, I've had enough. I just want to know somebody face to face. And we can only deal with this grain by grain of the sand in the ocean. We can only move it one by one. And if enough people begin to say, I'm going to move it, it will move. And we'll eventually tip the scales on this. And we'll eventually be at a place of justice for the most vulnerable.
Randy, thank you so much. What a pleasure to be able to sit down with you and have this conversation. And so thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So Shana, again, I just loved talking with Randy, and I'm so glad to be able to share this conversation with you and with our listeners.
What grabbed you in that section?
I chose the quotation
that
I read.
Oh, the Christian Meyer, yeah.
Yeah, I chose that, so it certainly resonated with me. And I just love that quotation because it talks about the moral imagination, and that religious practice is a school for the moral imagination. And moral imagination is, I just think it's crucial in so many areas of our common life together. I understand moral imagination to be the ability to transcend, to get beyond self-preoccupation and actually see another person.
And false gods and false prophets that permeate our culture.
And so this is what good religious practice will lead to. And I'm back to the intramural, like this is the core of our religion, not the judgmentalism, not the sexual purity judgmentalism that's often associated with Christianity in America. Really, religious practice is about, again, schooling the moral imagination so that we can see the humanity and see beyond ourselves to the humanity of others.
I had the visual when Randy was talking about walking in the ruts that have been made by those who traveled the way before us, and that's where we hone that imagination.
That is something that is a deep well to draw on for people who are grounded in a religious tradition. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there are other deep wells to draw on from people who are not grounded in a religious tradition.
But the notion of practice of doing something over and over again for the purpose of expanding one's moral imagination and I'm thinking about this as I'm talking, but that may be a specific domain of religion. I don't know that, if it exists outside of that, you say it may, and you may be right. As I'm sitting here thinking about that, I don't know. I don't know what that is. I mean, I know secular people get involved in doing work that's often called charity. You know, they may go to a soup kitchen and serve a meal or help prepare a meal. The difference is, without the religious component, that can very easily become an act of noblesse oblige. That is, those of us who have so much will give to the little people who have not. What Randy's talking about is something very different. He's talking about the whole host and guest thing. And it's that place where we encounter God at the margins. We know that we are ministering to those people out in the desert. You know, we're bringing them water, we're giving them direction, maybe we were bringing food, medical care. We're aware that we're ministering to them, but having walked in the rut, we are also powerfully aware of how they are ministering to us. And I don't know that that moral imagination gets honed someplace. If it does, I don't know where it is.
A related notion, Shana, which I loved that Randy said was, again, drawing on the Christian faith and tradition, Jesus calling us, he said, follow me. And so there wasn't an expectation that people would have it all figured out ahead of time. It's the practice leads us into, it's not brain work, it's body work. Mm. Put your body out there on the line. And that is the way that your moral imagination can be broadened.
Yeah. It reminds me of when I was in seminary and I was doing a self-study on world religions with Mark Heim, Professor Mark Heim. When we were talking about Islam, I thought it was very odd that adherents must first receive, you know, one of the first practices when one wants to become a Muslim is to speak the words, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And I thought that was an interesting place to start, as if they already had to believe that. Mark straightened me out and he said, no, they don't have to believe it, but they're going to say it until they do. The practice of it leads one into that. And in Judaism, so many practices, you know, designed to, you know, to keep the faithful on track with the things that God commands.
Let's talk about the host and guest element that Randy brought up. Can you share the story about the soup?
So in a previous lifetime, I was working as a professional musician with a woman by the name of Lori Wesley, and the two of us did a music video on homelessness. So as a part of pulling that music video together, we spent a lot of time in shelters and meeting homeless folks and hearing their stories. So one day we were at this shelter serving lunch, and as part of the crew who was serving lunch. And it was the tradition of this particular shelter that they would ask somebody to say a prayer before the meal. And there was a woman there. She was very big. I remember her being very big. And I remember my radar perceiving that there might be a mental health issue there. And that combination had elicited in me a fearful response. But when they asked for somebody to lift the prayer, she was the one who raised her head. And I thought to myself, this ought to be interesting. And the prayer she raised was simply this. She said, Lord, we know you'll be in this line today. Help us to treat you good. And that was it. And I was blown away. And I was like, well, I got it. God is a big black woman with a mental health issue. Clearly. I mean, it was just so clear and so there. And so, yeah, we're serving God who's going to show up in the line. I mean, talk about respecting the inherent worth and dignity of all people. Just absolutely amazing.
The divine that inhabits each person, the divine image that each person carries. I mean, that's the theology that springs up for me, hearing you tell that story and then hearing Randy, of course, talk about encounters in the desert. Mm-hmm. And here is a person receiving what sometimes is life-saving ministry, water in the desert. And yet the one giving the aid is also
being
receiving.
Saved.
And
is being saved.
Is being saved.
Yeah.
That is so right. That
is
so
also
right.
Being saved.
Because the humanity of both is being, it's emerging, it rises up in those kinds of encounters.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so right to point that out.
I have not encountered that in the desert. Those of us who have done chaplaincy, and most of us who are ordained ministers had to do some chaplaincy, have certainly encountered it at the bedside, you know, of the dying. We go to minister. I mean, some of the best sermons I've ever heard have been preached from a hospital bed. I've gone to offer something and only to find that I was the one receiving. I was the one being saved in no uncertain terms. Yeah.
So what's the takeaway for today?
Practice, practice, practice. And I think also, you know, one piece we didn't talk about, but was very striking to me was when Randy talked about the number of people who are dying in the desert. And I think that that was an eye opener for me. I know that people die in the desert. I don't think I was thinking in those numbers, you know, 20, 24,000 people. And, you know, once you know that, how can you be still? How can you do nothing? Takes me back to the story of the Good Samaritan. I mean, I know this stuff will disrupt our lives. You know, it absolutely will disrupt our lives if we choose to get active in the many movements that are calling us right now. But I think we have to think like the Good Samaritan, not so much about what will get messed up for us potentially if we reach out and help, but what will happen if we don't.
The takeaway for me, Shana, is the last thing we landed on, which is, and you said it beautifully, it's not just the person receiving the ministry who is saved, but it's both of those people, if you imagine a giver and a receiver, but then it's all of us who are saved because somehow that spiritual power, I really believe this, that in moments like that, there's a spiritual power that's released that it's light for all. Mm-hmm. It humanizes what can be a very dehumanized and becoming even crueler society.
I think it is a direct encounter with God. And for the non-religious or the secular, it is a direct encounter with the architecture of our interdependence. It's that moment when we realize that that architecture is, yes, metaphorical, and also actual, as we perceive our interconnection with one another. So it's very powerful.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine the light. We will be with you next Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. We are having a special show. We are going to consider
Thanksgiving.
Giving thanks.
It will be a good emotional lavage for those of you who may be driving to or coming from some very difficult family conversations or interactions. We know the blessing of family can be both blessing and curse. So we're going to offer you all a little something to listen to.
Find out more about What in God's Name at our website, whatingods.com. That's WHATINGODS. You can find us also on Facebook at What in God's. Shana, great to see you.
Good to see you, Chris.